you have the chance to win a Spring Super Sweeps from LAist. Donate $60 for one entry to win a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Check out all the other prizes too when you donate now at LAist.com/sweeps.
Coming up on Fresh Air with Terry Gross at noon, soccer star and political activist Megan Rapinoe with Terry Gross on Fresh Air right here on KPCC. And of course, our brand new program at 2 o'clock this afternoon, On Point with Meghna Chakrabarty. That's coming up this afternoon right here on KPCC. Three big U.S. Supreme Court decisions which came out this morning. Two of them, the cases are from right here in California. But let's begin with the one that comes from Pennsylvania, the case of a student at a public school there who was not chosen for the cheerleading team, and she used several vulgar references on social media in a post about not qualifying for the varsity team, and the Supreme Court decided 8-1 in favor of young Brandy Levy, who was 14 years old, a high school freshman at that time. Joining us to talk about the significance of this case and what it says about the freedom of speech for high school students is Kimberly Robinson, Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg Law. She also co-hosts Bloomberg's Cases and Controversies podcast. Let's start with you, Kimberly. Great to have you back with us. So what specifically did the court say about this case and this young woman's actions?
Well, the issue for the justices was whether or not schools could punish speech that takes place off of the school campus. So in a landmark ruling called Tinker, the Supreme Court said on campus, schools do have some discretion to punish school student speech, but it's limited. It has to kind of fit in some exceptions. You know, they have to substantially detract from the school environment or has to be threatening to someone. But the court has never set down the lines for off-campus speech. Now, the lower court here said, you know, any off-campus speech can't be regulated by student or school administrators. But the Supreme Court pulled that back a little bit. It said, look, there are going to be some instances where it's okay for the school and appropriate for them to step in. But this just isn't one of them. And instead, you know, courts are really going to have to do a case-by-case analysis to see if, you know, the school's actions really comport with the First Amendment. So even though it kind of rejected the lower court's really broad ruling, it's still considered a win for students because it does provide these really big and broad protections for their speech.
And the multiple uses of the F word and, you know, flipping off and the Snapchat posting here toward the cheerleading squad in the school. So if that isn't deemed to be enough of a disruption for the high school to take disciplinary action, did the court wade in at all to what would cross that line in an off-campus posting?
Well, they were really hesitant to set a really bright line rule. But we can see both from the oral arguments in this case and from the ruling here that the justices are really concerned about two things. One, they're concerned about bullying. And even the cheerleader here, her counsel, you know, agreed that bullying is something that schools need to have some leeway to be able to regulate. And then the other thing that it seemed like the justices were hesitant to touch was technology. You know, I think there's an acknowledgement by all of the justices that, you know, technology is ever changing and it's growing more ubiquitous. And I think they were hesitant to set a line for future cases that might really depend on things that we can't even imagine up right now.
Also joining us, in addition to Kimberly Robinson of Bloomberg Law, is Professor Pradeepan Gulasekaram, who's at Santa Clara Law. He specializes in constitutional, among other areas of the law. Professor Deep, so good to have you with us again.
Thank you for having me, Larry.
Your thoughts on the significance of the court and how they tailored this decision?
So I think this opinion is important, but in a sense it's an easy case for the justices to resolve. But as the reporter was saying, I think the concern of the court are the future cases that are coming down the line that are going to be much harder to resolve. I think what you see here is a real difficulty that the court is having between trying to distinguish what is on campus versus off campus and how that works out in a world where the internet might cross both of those boundaries. And I think what we'll see now is perhaps in the future other messy cases in which you have uses of social media, private platforms, perhaps to bully, perhaps to harass, to threaten students, which can have effects within the school. And those are the lines that the court is going to have to resolve later on.
So does that mean that there's going to be an onus on schools or on districts to show harm from something that was done by a student, that it couldn't necessarily be anticipatory of harm, but you'd have to show actual harm?
Certainly the Tinker case, Tinker versus Des Moines, 1969 case, establishes the idea that there actually has to be a record of, that the school has to produce a record of the actual disruption to the working of the school, to the rights of other students, in order to justify the imposition on free speech. And one of the difficulties, I think, of allowing incursions on the First Amendment within public schools is that you create this paradox. And the paradox is this. In a pluralistic society, school is one of the places where we teach fundamental values of an informed citizenry, civic values, and the Bill of Rights. And so there's a little bit of a paradox in saying that in order to teach those values, you have to restrict some of those values and restrict the free exchange of ideas and opinions.
We're talking with Santa Clara Law Professor Pradeepan Gulasekaram. Also with us, Kimberly Robinson from Bloomberg Law, co-host of Bloomberg's Cases and Controversies podcast. If you have questions for our guests about these three Supreme Court decisions we're talking about this morning, we're at 866-893-KPECC, 866-893-5722, or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Kimberly, we also have a major case, this one California-based, about whether union organizers are able to come on private agricultural land and spend significant hours working on organizing the farm workers on those ag properties. What did the court decide here?
Well, I think that depends a lot about whom you ask. And so, you know, the court either gave a big win, big property win to, you know, property owners, or this is a union busting case that's going to make it harder, you know, for unions, particularly agricultural workers, to be able to organize collectively. It's probably a little bit of both. So the case here deals specifically with the Constitution's taking clause, and that provision is pretty straightforward. It just, the Supreme Court decided as this today, it said the government must pay for what it takes. But the Supreme Court precedent on this in around this area has kind of gotten a little squishy. So there are all sorts of various tests depending on what kind of regulation or what kind of action the government is taking. And the one that's important here is this distinction between kind of completely taking land, think of taking land in order to build a highway or a strip mall, as opposed to just regulating land, something that allows, you know, the property owner to do a lot with their land, but limits them in some way. And, you know, in an ideologically divided decision, the Supreme Court went big. They said this is one of those, you know, per se takings that the government just cannot do unless they provide what's known as just compensation.
And this goes back to a 1975 California law allowing union officials to come onto this agricultural land because the thinking, I guess, of the legislature at the time is it's too hard to organize farm workers if you're doing it away from the fields. You just don't have that access to them. Deep, your thoughts about the court's decision here, as Kimberly just said, along the 6-3 ideological divide here.
Right. So I think this case, as the Justice Roberts opinion for the majority rightly notes, is really about differing conceptions of property rights. if you look at the majority view here, the right to own property, private property ownership, is an absolute right. It's a right to exclude all people for all purposes, and I think it's a very robust view of what private property rights allow. It ends up being an opinion that is going to have significant anti-labor effects, anti-unionizing effects. On the other hand, if you look at the dissent view, they say, you know, property rights, private property rights are of course important, but just because you allow a specific group of people to be on private property for a limited purpose and for a limited time does not mean that you've in any way really taken the property from the private owner. You haven't diminished its economic value to that owner. You haven't, in general, stopped that owner from keeping people off that land that they don't want to have. And in this case, the nursery would have, I think it's a strawberry farm, would have still continued to get strawberries, make money off of that, et cetera. And so it's two very different views of what private property means. I think the dissent view is that in a society of connected individuals, we have competing values. One is the value of private property and private ownership, but also we have values of free and fair labor and making sure that there are employment protections.
There are a couple of growers involved here fighting the United Farm Workers. Cedar Point Nursery, which is a strawberry grower in Doris up in the Central Valley, and Fowler Packing Company based in Fresno. It's a big player in citrus and table grapes. They argued that that 1975 California law that was struck down today allows organizers to meet with workers during their lunch hour and for an hour before and after shifts, that that's no longer necessary because of digital communications, that you don't need union organizers to connect with people in that same face-to-face way. Professor Deep, your thoughts about that?
Well, you know, I think that if you're a union organizer in a union, if in fact there were much better ways of organizing, that they would in fact have taken advantage of those opportunities. Part of the reason this law was enacted in 1975 and still remains critical 40 years later is because this is a notoriously difficult population of workers.
I think we just lost the professor. We'll get him right back. And Kimberly Robinson of Bloomberg Law also with us. We're at 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Perfect timing because we had a break scheduled anyway. We'll get the professor and we'll get Kimberly back with us as well. We'll be back in 1 minute on AirTalk. We have him back with us now, Santa Clara Law Professor Pradeepan Gulasekaram, known as Deep, and Kimberly Robinson, Bloomberg Law Supreme Court reporter. Deep, I wanted to ask you before we move on to the third case that SCOTUS announced this morning. What are the potential repercussions on other industries and the ability of unions to organize workers, does striking down this California law not affect other industries?
Well, it may affect other industries, but and if you look at the dissent, they list several instances in which this might matter. The reason this might matter is that the government uses temporary incursions onto private property in a variety of areas. For example, government inspectors for food safety, government inspectors for drug safety, education, child care, home inspections, all of these require private parties or government inspectors to go on private property. And so one of the concerns here is if you have a very robust version of private property rights, perhaps lots of regulations that allow third parties for temporary purposes onto private property could all be struck down. Now, the court doesn't go so far in the majority, but that's the significant concern looking to the future.
Really, because I think they could draw a very bright line there between government itself and non-governmental entities.
Sure, and that is one of the ways in which you see the majority attempting to make that distinction. Of course, if we think more broadly about governmental interest in, for example, labor protections, it very well might be that the governmental interest in labor protection requires a third party like a union to have some access to those lands. But you're right, it is possible, maybe going into the future, that you'll have to make a sharp distinction between government inspectors and all other people who can enter properties.
All right. So we have another case, this from Sonoma County in Northern California, that limits when police officers pursuing a suspect can enter a home without a warrant. Kimberly, can you share with us a bit about what this case is about?
Sure. So one of my colleagues wrote a story earlier today, which describe this as the latest decision that enhances protections for the home. We've seen the Supreme Court really try to reinforce the idea that the home is your castle and it should be free from government intrusion. So, you know, the Fourth Amendment generally requires police to get a warrant, but the Supreme Court has created lots of exceptions to that. And one exception is that a suspect who's been thought to have committed a felony and who is fleeing from police apprehension can be seized and searched by the government without a warrant. So the cops don't have to stop mid-flight and try to get a warrant in that case. The issue here was whether that was true for lesser crimes, so-called misdemeanors. And the justices in a pretty broadly agreed-upon case, in a 7-2 case, refused to lay down a categorical rule that allowed these warrantless searches in this particular with these particular crimes, but it stopped short of saying that police could never enter the home without a warrant. Instead, again, it said this is something that courts are just going to have to look to on a case-by-case basis.
I was reading about this, that the court had previously said when police are in hot pursuit of a suspect believed to have committed a more serious crime, a felony, that they can enter a home without a warrant. So, Kimberly, in this case, is it that they didn't feel that the police had that plausible reason to believe a more serious crime had been committed?
Well, that's something that they really left for, you know, the lower court to sort out. Was there kind of one of these exceptions, you know, harm to other people or something along those lines, destruction of evidence that could allow for the warrantless entry here? But, you know, I think if we look at the facts here, you know, as a California native, I can appreciate that, you know, the individual here was initially stopped because they were playing loud music and obnoxiously honking their horn. That seems vastly different, at least to the Supreme Court justices, than somebody who is fleeing from, you know, a shooting or an armed robbery or something like that. So again, you know, the court has left it up to the lower courts to really figure out case by case whether or not this is something that the police need, given kind of the heat of the moment, or whether it's something that can wait while they go ahead and get a warrant.
This case from 2016 involving a Sonoma County resident, Arthur Lang. An officer saw Lang, just as Kimberly described, driving his station wagon with music blaring, honking his horn. So the officer said he believed noise violations were occurring. So officer turned on the car lights to get Lang to stop. Lang drove just a few seconds more, turned into his driveway, so he was almost home, entered his garage, closed the garage door. Then the officer put his foot under the door so that it would reopen with the automatic opening mechanism. And then the officers went into the Lang's garage once they got the door open, and smelling alcohol in his breath, they then arrested and charged him with driving under the influence, as well as the excessive noise offense. Professor, your thoughts about the significance of the court's finding here?
Well, I think that, as you said, this case is in some ways dictated by these facts and the fact that the police were not actually pursuing him for a significant crime, at least initially, right? It was for this loud music and the honking of the horn. I think more broadly, when you look at the Fourth Amendment, what's happened is that you have this warrant requirement, but there have been significant exceptions to that warrant requirement. So multiple instances and circumstances in which the police can justify a search or a more intrusive holding of somebody even without a warrant requirement. And in many ways, those exceptions have threatened to overcome and essentially undermine the rule that you need a warrant. So at the very minimum, this case is at least put some stopgap on that, some small stopgap on that. that, to say that in this case at least, this did not warrant going beyond the warrant requirement or disposing with the warrant requirement. So in that case, it's important, although highly limited, I think, to these sorts of facts.
Deep, I'm just seeing a fourth case that the court announced decision in, and I'll just give a thumbnail, and if you're familiar with it, you can let me know. Supreme Court today ruling the structure of the agency that oversees mortgage giants Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac violates separation of powers principles in the Constitution. The justices sent the case involving Federal Housing Finance Agency, which oversees Fannie and Freddie, back to a lower court for additional proceedings. The organization created during the 2008 financial crisis, shareholders of the two companies had argued that the FHFA structure was unconstitutional and that the justices should set aside an agreement under which companies have paid the government billions. So anyway, we got the Supreme Court with that decision, and I don't have time, unfortunately, to go back to Professor Deep to ask his thoughts about that, but I'm sure you'll hear more about it on All Things Considered with Austin Cross coming up in just an hour here on KPCC right after Fresh Air. My thanks to Kimberly Robinson, U.S. Supreme Court reporter for Bloomberg Law. Her podcast is Cases and Controversies. And Pradeepan Gulasekaram, professor at Santa Clara Law, joining us as well with his expertise. Have a terrific afternoon. Again, soccer star and political activist Megan Rapinoe comes up next with Terry Gross on Fresh Air right here on KPCC. I'll be back with you tomorrow morning at 10 for the next Air Talk. Have a wonderful day.
The LAS Spring Super Sweeps is happening now. You can win amazing prizes while supporting your source for local fact-based journalism. One lucky grand prize winner will get to choose a brand new Lexus or $25,000 in cash. Other prizes include an electric bike from Juice Bikes and $1,000 gas gift cards. Your donation of $60 gets you one entry to win, and the more you give, the more entries you get. Donate now at LAS.com/sweeps.